Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. In a bit, I'll review some newly released figures on income, poverty, debt, and wealth, and after that we'll hear a long interview with the distinguished analyst of Middle Eastern Affairs, Gilbert Achkar. First, some words on income, poverty, and wealth in the United States. A couple of weeks ago, the Federal Reserve released the 2013 edition of its Triennial Survey of Consumer Finances, a marvelously detailed and rigorous look at the material well-being of American households. A measure of that rigor, interviews last on average 85 minutes, though in complicated cases they can go on for hours. One of the strengths of the survey is the particular attention it pays to richer households, who are generally overlooked in more routine census surveys. Some highlights. First, income. Despite a decent economic performance between the last survey in 2010 and 2013, median incomes fell by almost 5% in real terms over the period. The median is the midpoint of the income distribution. Half of households have incomes higher than the median and half lower. The reason I, like most other analysts of income and wealth data, use medians is because the more familiar average, the mean, is distorted by the far better performance at the top than the rest of the population. The bottom 20% of the income distribution fared a little less poorly than the median, down just over 3% between 2010 and 2013, but the top 10% were up over 4%. The Fed notes in an article accompanying the release of the survey that data from the 2013 survey confirm that the shares of income and wealth held by affluent families are at modern historically high levels. Median net worth fell by 2% between 2010 and 2013. That non-recovery in the averages left the 2007 to 2010 decline intact. Median net worth last year was 40% below 2007's level. It's back, in inflation-adjusted terms, to where it was in 1992. For the top 10%, however, median net worth is just 12% below its 2007 level and is 74% above its 1992 level. These median figures for the top 10% are dominated by the moderately rich, people with net worths of just under $2 million. The very, very top is doing a lot better than these numbers say. A reminder of just how narrowly financial assets are held. While 95% of households held some sort of financial asset in 2013, in more than half the cases, those were just checking and savings accounts and the like. The next most widely held financial asset was a retirement account, held by just under half of households. Just 14% of households owned stocks, and of those who did, their median value was just $27,000. You have to get pretty far up the wealth distribution to find significant stock holdings. Even between the 75th and 90th percentiles, let's call them the upper middle class, just 28% held stocks, with a median value of $20,000. At least in the immediate sense, the stock market is close to economically irrelevant for about 80% of the population, despite all the attention it gets. These figures exclude retirement accounts, where wealth is somewhat less concentrated. As I said, just under half of households have retirement accounts, a share that's been in steady decline over the decades, but such accounts have a median value of just $59,000. Needless to say, $59,000 will not last you very long in retirement. Indebtedness mostly fell between 2010 and 2013. The famed household deleveraging, visible in the macro stats, is also visible in this finer-grained view. Median debt was off 20%, and the fraction of families that spent over 40% of their income on paying off their debts fell below the 2001 level. The average household with debt devoted 11% of its income to servicing it, the lowest share since the survey began in 1989. Education debt is the real odd man out in the deleveraging story. The share of families with education debt rose from 19% in 2010 to 20% in 2013, and the median value of that debt rose 15%. From $13,900 to $16,000. But the heaviest increases came in households with heads under 40. In 2001, 22% of the under 40s had education debt, a share that nearly doubled to 39% in 2013. But despite all the ink, or its virtual equivalent, that education debt gets, balances owed and debt service burdens are relatively modest for most borrowers. Median education debt last year was just under $17,000. Young, that is, under 40, families with education debt and at least one bachelor's degree in the house devoted 4% of their income to debt service. The 100,000-plus education debtors account for less than 6% of those with any education debt at all. Almost two-thirds have less than $25,000 in debt. But these numbers keep growing with no sign of reversal. Earlier this week, the Census Bureau released its annual survey of income, poverty, and health insurance coverage. Because of technical changes to the health insurance survey, the results aren't comparable to earlier years, so I'll reserve commentary for now. Median household income rose for the first time since 2007, but by a mere 0.3%. It remains 8% below its pre-recession high, and almost 9% below its previous high in 1999. The recession of the early 2000s took a toll on median incomes that was barely reversed by the 2002 to 2007 expansion, and those gains were more than undone by the Great Recessions. Black households did better than the broad population last year. Their median incomes rose over 2% in real terms, but they were hit much harder during the recessions of the last decade. Median income for black households was still 9% below its pre-recession level and 14% below its all-time high in 2000. This is a remarkably awful performance. Hispanic households gained over 3% last year, but they too remain well below 2007 and 2000 levels, though not quite as deeply as black households. Black households have incomes that are about two-thirds the national average, Hispanics about four-fifths. Inequality remained high, but at least it didn't get any worse between 2012 and 2013. Poverty had its first meaningful decline since 2006 last year, falling from 15% of the population to 14.5%. Female-headed households had a poverty rate more than twice the national average, 33%. The black poverty rate was unchanged at 27%, close to twice the national average. For so-called Hispanic households, the poverty rate declined by 2 points to 23.5%, which is more than twice the non-Hispanic white rate of just under 10%. All these poverty numbers are well above where they were in 2007 and 2000. And the official definition of poverty is quite strict, an income of less than $12,000 for a single person and less than $18,500 for a family of three. What does this blizzard of numbers mean? It means that for most Americans, the recovery from the Great Recession has been barely noticeable, and the long-term crisis in material well-being goes on. In good years, incomes rise and poverty falls modestly. In bad years, they're savaged. If all those numbers made your head spin, I'll post the text of this to my blog at lbo-news.com, lbo-news.com. My only guest today is Gilbert Ashkar. Ashkar was born in Lebanon in 1951 and lived there until moving to France in 1983. He taught in Paris for nearly 20 years. Since 2007, he's been a professor of development studies and international relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He's the author of a number of books, most recently The People Want, his examination of the so-called Arab Spring, which came out in 2012. Those heady days seem rather distant now, with the latest of Israel's assaults on Gaza still fresh in mind, Syria deep in a long and bloody civil war, and the U.S. now getting more deeply involved in the fight against ISIS in and around Iraq. Ashkar was criticized by many on the left for his support for some degree of intervention in Libya a few years ago, and you'll hear him voice support for supplying the Free Syrian Army with offensive weapons. I'm still of the school that finds any U.S. military intervention deeply problematic, no matter how humane the stated intentions. But Ashkar knows the region far better than I do, so I listen respectfully to what he has to say on the topic. Gilbert Ashkar.
How do you read what Israel's intentions were in the war on Gaza? What were they aiming to accomplish, and did they accomplish it?
Well, I think that the recent Israeli onslaught on Gaza is not directly connected to the overall regional situation. It's more directly related to the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And, well, my reading of it is that this was a premeditated attack, which was actually a reaction to the recent moves by Hamas to moderate its stance and get into a reconciliation agreement with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, or the so-called Palestinian Authority. And I think this development, especially when it led to no negative reaction on the Western side, including the United States, just was seen by Israel as threatening their own policy on all that. You know, this Netanyahu government believes more threatened by anything looking like moderation on the Palestinian side than by what they would call extremism. And they do their best to provoke the Palestinians or provoke Hamas into reactions that they could label as extremist or terrorist or the like. You know, you have a joke about the meaning of a peace offensive to be taken literally here, in the sense that that's the kind of offensive that Israel fears most. They initially reacted by seizing the pretext of the assassination of three teenagers in the West Bank and launched a campaign, a very brutal campaign in the West Bank, rearresting a lot of the people they had released some time ago when you had this exchange for the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. And the government immediately put the blame on Hamas, even though they couldn't produce any real proof of that. So that looked very much like you remember the Bush administration putting the blame of 9/11 on Iraq, because they were looking for a pretext to invade Iraq. So here you have the same. The Netanyahu government seized this first pretext to launch this very provocative, brutal arrest campaign in the West Bank, knowing that this would lead, as it usually does, to some rocket fires from Gaza, and then launching a very obviously premeditated aggression, preconceived, pre-designed aggression on the Gaza Strip. In all that, I think the goal was to justify the radicalization of the Israeli government's own stance, as illustrated by their new decisions on settlement expansion and the rest.
And so from their point of view, the operation was a success?
No, I mean, it wasn't a success in the sense that militarily, it wasn't impressive. It didn't force Hamas into capitulation. And that led to this odd situation where both sides claim success and victory. But I think everyone agrees on the fact that it wasn't a success for Israel from that point of view. Not even into pushing Hamas into some kind of renewed radicalization, which would put an end to their new orientation. It actually re-enhanced Hamas's prestige in the Arab world and among the Palestinians. So from that point of view, it can't be seen as a success. But I think the Netanyahu government does not very much measure success or failure from the political angle. What they're most interested in is carrying on with their own creeping annexation of the West Bank and creating situations where this can proceed forward.
What do you see as their long-term plan? They want to annex these territories completely? Then what happens to the people who live there?
No, I mean, annex the whole territory completely is impossible unless you have a new Nakba, that is the Arab term for the expulsion of the vast majority of the Palestinians from the land Israel seized in 1948 when its foundation was proclaimed. Short of this, I mean, the annexation of lands with their population would would imply giving the inhabitants citizenship rights, or else creating a situation with of open apartheid. I mean, not a de facto apartheid as it is, but a very open one, which would, of course, create a lot of political problems for the Israeli state. So, no, it's a matter of carrying on with this kind of unilateral decisions, as they did in Gaza when Sharon withdrew his troops in 2005. In the West Bank, they want to consolidate their control of all these sections of the territory far beyond moderate, between quote marks, the most moderate Palestinian leadership might accept. And the only way to do that is through a unilateral decision implemented by force. That's what basically they keep doing.
And what is the likelihood of them moving towards a real formal apartheid system?
No, I don't think that precisely. I mean, we just said that the formal apartheid system is something I think Israel can't afford. If you look already at the clear irritation of the Israeli establishment towards the boycott campaigns, the BDS campaign, one can be sure that any situation of formal apartheid would just lead to a very big increase in such forms of action, and would also, of course, lead to serious trouble for Israel with its traditional supporters, including the United States, in the sense that Washington would not be able to condone any kind of formal apartheid. So, no, I don't think this is on the cards right now, nor is the mass expulsion of the Palestinians for also the same reasons, the mass expulsion of the Palestinians from the West Bank. So, no, the alternative is to control as much of the territory that Israel wants to control on the West Bank, and instead of apartheid, keep these forms of Bantustan, and that's exactly what the territories of the Palestinian Authority are presently, closer to Bantustan than to apartheid.
And the United States is totally fine with what Israel is doing?
No, totally fine is, I think, would be an overstatement, an exaggeration. It's obvious that the United States is unhappy with the extremism, again, with quote marks here, of Netanyahu. Netanyahu has been behaving in even provocative manners in his relation with Washington and with the Obama administration. He has involved himself even in domestic U.S. politics and openly siding with the opponents of the administration, and even playing also on internal contradictions within the administration itself, as transpired from Hillary Clinton's recent statements, for which she deserved the title of Netanyahu's best lawyer, by Peter Beinart. No, the administration, the Obama administration, is definitely irritated, but as in many other issues, on many other issues, this administration has shown that it had very little political courage, and that you need political courage to exert pressure on Israel if you are at the helm of the United States of America.
I'm speaking with Gilbert Ashkar, who teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And now let's turn to ISIS, or, well, it has many names, the Islamic State.
The recent one is IS.
Yes, yes. So let's call it IS. The U.S. government calls it ISIL, but who knows. the Obama administration has developed some sort of strategy, if you can call it that, for fighting it. What do you make of what their plan is?
Well, I think that they try to give the impression that they have something that you could call a strategy. I think it's a very big name for this very limited kind of policies that they have, and they have been having for now 3 years. When faced with the unfolding situation, first in Syria and then in Iraq, basically this so-called strategy is about renewing what the previous administrations regarded as something needed for U.S. Military campaigns, which is to have the support of a coalition of the willing, as Donald Rumsfeld used to call it in the past, and a coalition including allies of from the states that are most directly concerned with the events. In this respect, here what John Kerry has been busy doing through his recent travels is to bring on board the Arab states in the Middle East plus Turkey in this coalition, to fight IS, but more precisely that the issue of the strikes against IS and the issue of the fate of the Syrian so-called moderate opposition to Bashar al-Assad in Syria. On these issues, there is hardly any clear policy.
What would this moderate Syrian opposition, does such a thing exist?
No, of course it exists in the sense that you have the Free Syrian Army, you have around this number, a collection of groups, some of them who would refer to this banner, some others not, but who are not of the most extreme fundamentalist kind, as are the two groups which are of Al-Qaeda background. The official, the one that has the official Al-Qaeda franchise, which is called the Jabhat al-Nusra, the Al-Nusra Front, and IS, which is basically a split from the global Al-Qaeda network, or a group that split from that. So yeah, you have an opposition in Syria, an armed opposition, which is opposed to the regime, but also opposed to IS and Nusra, and which has clashed with IS in particular. Now the issue is that this opposition, especially here, I'm speaking of the Free Syrian Army, the mainstream one, has been very much weakened over the years, precisely by the lack of support. They were, if you want, the relatively poor guys in the Syrian situation, with a regime heavily backed by Russia and Iran, and some fraction of the oppositions getting more funding than them, especially fractions with religious references. And of course, you had later on the development of the two Al-Qaeda-like groups, which managed to gather momentum quite rapidly. So the FSA has been squeezed between these two developments. Now, of course, if they were to receive serious and substantial support, and especially weapons, the defensive weapons they need, anti-aircraft and anti-tank, and other forms of support, then they might very well regain a good part of the ground that they lost over the three past years.
What do you make of Hillary Clinton's critique that had Obama armed the Free Syrian Army earlier, the ISIS would not have come to be?
I think there's definitely an element of truth in this critique, but it's not only Hillary Clinton who's been formulating this this critique. She's just the most probably prominent person to have voiced this kind of critique, but you have countless people who have been saying that for and not just recently as Hillary Clinton did, but for 3 years now. You had a lot of people warning that this would happen if the mainstream opposition were not supported. The issue is that if you look at the outcome of all that, you have an Obama administration that not only refused to give the Syrian mainstream opposition the defensive weapons they were requesting, again, anti-aircraft and anti-tank, and these are defensive weapons, and I very much emphasize the term defensive here. So not only were they denied these weapons by the administration, but the administration vetoed any delivery of such weapons by its allies in the region, which are armed by the United States. So in that sense, and I keep repeating that because I think one should be really aware of that, there is a direct responsibility of the U.S. administration in the terrible massacre that has been occurring in Syria. The United States is directly responsible in this massacre for having denied the victims the right or the means to defend themselves. This is a direct form of responsibility. I mean, the butcher is the Bashar al-Assad regime and its forces, but in refusing to give the victims the means to defend themselves, you have a direct share of responsibility in the massacre. So I think this is the first point to make here. Now, in doing that, the United States also let the situation become so terrible that this proved a real breeding ground for the most the wildest forms of radicalization, of which IS is an outcome. For people to join a group of such madness, you really need conditions which are extremely revolting. I mean, extremely intolerable. I mean, this is the real basis for the growth of such of such groups in the first place. In the same way that the brutality of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, especially after the massacre of Fallujah in 2004, and the Abu Ghraib torture and all that, all this led Al-Qaeda in Iraq at a certain point to become a major force. People forget about that. So this is the first reason. And then, therefore, this was allowed to happen in Syria. And at the same time, of course, in refusing the support to this mainstream opposition, those who took advantage of that were those who were the most, those who were the most dedicated, if you want, to the extreme forms of struggle, and they took over. They took over because they managed. They had, first of all, some experience already in Iraq, which they imported in Syria. They seized strategic parts of the country, including from the point of funding, that is, oil sources. All this was done with the regime turning a blind eye towards them and never fighting them until very, very recently. The Syrian regime just was quite happy to see the development of IS. And Washington was just watching all that.
We're listening to an interview with Gilbert Ashkar, Professor of Development Studies and International Relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. We'll return with the second half of the interview in a minute. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Some have returned from the album High Life, a really fine collaboration between Brian Eno and Carl Hyde, which came out early this summer. Now back to Gilbert Ashkar, the author and academic who specializes in the politics of the Middle East.
What was Syria's interest in seeing the development of IS?
Well, for the Syrian regime, IS is the preferred enemy, of course. It's a matter of having your preferred enemies. And here you can have parallels. For instance, it's clear that, as I was explaining earlier, for Netanyahu, the preferred enemy is Hamas, and Hamas that is completely demonized, Hamas that would behave as Netanyahu would wish it to behave, that is, in what he would describe as terrorism or extremism or whatever. And the same goes for the Syrian regime. They don't want a strong opposition that can claim to be democratic and secular and therefore appeal on the one hand to those parts of the Syrian population that are still under regime control and on the other hand to the global and particularly the Western public opinion. So they very much prefer to have IS facing them, which they believe might actually enhance their own chances of being seen again as allies of the West. And that's exactly the message the Syrian regime immediately tried to convey when you had this breakthrough of IS in Iraq. It was again getting back to the same tune that they have been singing from the day one of the uprising, exactly like, for instance, Gaddafi did from day one of the uprising in Libya in 2011, which is to say, well, these are jihadist terrorists. We are fighting Al-Qaeda, and we are part of the war on terror. And actually, the West should be supporting us as allies in the war on terror. That's exactly the message they want to get through. So that's the reason why they behaved in this way.
Who is funding and arming IS?
They are not funded and armed, I think, by any state, any government. And there's a lot of conspiracy theory about such things. People want always to see states, whichever state they hate most, as being behind those phenomena that are the less palatable. Al-Qaeda was not the product. I mean, Al-Qaeda, as it developed in its fight against the U.S. and the Saudi Kingdom from the early 90s, it was not manipulated by any state. It was a phenomenon rooted in social, political conditions, as many, several such phenomena in the history of what is called terrorism. So IS got some funding in the beginning from probably some treasure, treasury they had accumulated in Iraq. IS is a continuation of the Islamic State in Iraq, which was the name that Al-Qaeda had given itself there before being defeated in Iraq by the U.S. Occupation after the year 2007 when it changed strategy. To this you should add the funding they get from fundraising. They have networks doing fundraising in Muslim countries, especially in Arab Gulf countries, at the entrance of mosque, you know, in the name of the jihad in Syria or whatever. But in addition and to that, and more importantly, they manage, as I said, quite cleverly to get hold of importing funding sources in Syria itself. They took over banks in the regions they controlled, and they seized control of oil fields, of other sources of racketeering, if you want, for their income. So they manage, therefore, to fund their themselves. You know, if we were to believe that every movement that manages to get control of areas through guerrilla struggle is funded by some state, you wouldn't be able to account for so many events in recent history.
By some accounts, it organizes itself with remarkable corporate discipline. I mean, it sounds like they issue annual reports, they have strategic plans, a management structure.
In the same way that Al-Qaeda, you know, to have masterminded, to have designed the 9/11 attacks is not something easy. You know, it was very remarkably well organized. It was a terrible, terribly appalling massacre. But from the point of view of organization, it took some degree of sophistication in organizing something of this kind. So we shouldn't believe that these guys, because they are mad politically, are stupid. They can be very intelligent and completely mad politically.
Well, the beheading videos seem like remarkably successful propaganda interventions.
Yes, I mean, this is, well, I don't know how successful it is, because, I mean, ultimately, this may be more appalling than anything else. Even with regard to the population groups, generations that the IS propaganda tries to impress, these beheadings were trying to frighten the Western governments and public opinions into not getting directly involved in the military action against IS. So from that point of view, I think they are rather counterproductive. Here you have some lack of, I would say, lack of political intelligence rather than the rest. But the kind of propaganda that they did, which was quite effective, is the previous kind of propaganda where they will spread videos giving you the impression that it's almost as romantic as any left-wing guerrillas of the 60s, you know.
I'm speaking with Gilbert Ashkar, who teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. The military action that the U.S. is now orchestrating, will that be successful? What do you see the results of it will be?
I mean, the United States has definitely the military means to strike IS a very big blow. But the key point, as everyone is aware, including, of course, the guys in Washington, is that you need forces on the ground to really eradicate IS. You can't eradicate a movement like this just by airstrikes. So they need troops on the ground to do the job. And the United States, having had its fingers burned in Iraq, and severely actually, is of course absolutely not enthused about any prospect of sending troops again to that country. So that's why they keep asserting that they won't, and that there's no question of having any boots on the ground except for advisors or the like, but that basically they rely upon their the regional forces to do the job. In some sense, it wouldn't be the first time. If you think of it, the war in Afghanistan, the initial war in Afghanistan, was also done like this. I mean, although you had more direct involvement, but basically it was U.S. airstrikes plus the Northern Alliance of the Mujahideen against the Taliban. So here they want the local forces to play a major role in that, and that also explains why Washington did not react that rapidly. If you think of it, it's they are really taking their time in devising all this. And why is it so? Well, the reason is that paradoxically, as it might sound, but the fact is that the U.S. Has taken advantage of the spread of IS in trying to restore some of the balance lost to the advantage of Iran over the last few years. The United States left Iraq in 2011 with the dismay of seeing this country shift more and more to the sphere of Iran's hegemony, and with even al-Maliki even going to Moscow to discuss arms deal with the Russians. So, this was absolutely terrible for Washington. This proved the extent to which Iraq has been a real disaster in U.S. imperial history. Now, the spread of IS with the way in which Maliki's army in the region where this breakthrough took place, the way the army disbanded and all that was of course a severe blow to the Maliki regime and hence to Iran behind this behind Maliki, and Washington therefore seized the opportunity to demand changes in the Iraqi government. And they got rid of Maliki, and they are pushing for a political formula in Iraq that would satisfy the Arab Sunnis, the Iraqi Arab Sunnis, and be at the same time, of course, much more open to Washington's influence than what the Maliki government had become. With its reliance on Iran, so that's what you get. And if you listen carefully to Obama's press conference a few days ago, the message was that we need to. He didn't say it in these words, but basically, the meaning was we need to keep the Sunnis happy. And that's our strategy now. We made the mistake of relying too much in Iraq on the Shia, and we paid the price for it. We need to keep the Sunnis happy. We need regionally to have a Sunni alliance because IS is an extremist force developing among the Sunnis, and we don't want to have such phenomena developing. This is a big threat to our interests. So basically, that's what they are trying to do, and that's also the reason why, although you had a lot of voices in the establishment and all that, calling for some kind of deal between Washington and the Syrian regime, the Obama administration, of course, understand that this would be counterproductive because precisely if the goal is to keep the Arab Sunni, which represent the vast majority in the Arab world, the Sunnis, if the goal is to keep them happy, you can't have a deal with Bashar al-Assad, and actually any kind of deal with Bashar al-Assad might also profit IS, precisely because then all those mainstream opposition fighters or whatever who are completely, have a very deep resentment, hatred of the Assad regime, especially after all these killings, destructions, and all that, well, they would be tempted to join forces with IS.
How does Iran figure into this? And does the U.S. refusal to negotiate with Iran, does that make any sense?
No, first of all, the U.S. Has always been negotiating in some forms with Iran, and this is a myth. Actually, even the Bush administration, Maliki was set in government by U.S. pressure with Iran's support. And although the Bush administration was had a hard line on Iran on the broader regional level during its last years in Iraq, this administration, the Bush administration, was actually coordinating with the Iranians in their support of the Maliki government. And this, the story goes on like this. Now, in the recent period, a few months ago, you had some gestures of moderating Washington's stance towards Iran. So there were a few things. Although you had this issue of Syria, but it looked like Washington was hoping that Iran might help at some point in finding a political compromise in Syria, or pushing for a political compromise in Syria. And of course, Washington knows well that the Assad government, the Assad regime in Syria, depends totally on Iran. They can't even afford to refuse anything that Iran might decide for them, because they depend entirely on Iran for their funding, for all that. They are completely backed by Iran, not to mention the fact that those who allowed the regime to go on the counteroffensive were actually troops sent by Iran from Lebanon and from Iraq. So all this is something that's very much in the mind in Washington. And there were at some point hopes that Iran might be willing to cooperate at that level. But recently, with what happened, and that's what I just said, that they saw in this change of situation in Iraq an opportunity, and that goes with actually now raising the tone against Iran, and also trying in this way to please, again, we get back to that, the Arab Sunnis, to please the Saudi kingdom, which was extremely disappointed with Washington's soft stance on Iran, as they saw it.
And finally, I saw an interview with you recently where you described a dynamic of increasing, mutually reinforcing, self-reinforcing violence and reaction in the region. Is that what you see for the future? Is there any way out of it?
Well, for the time being, that's what we have. We have a local version of what I called several years ago, after 9/11, the clash of barbarisms. It took the form of a clash between the barbarisms, the barbarism of the United States in the region, which peaked with the occupation of Iraq and what happened after that, and the barbarisms of the developments of the Al Qaeda like developments in Iraq and other places, and this appalling series of killings of slaughters in Iraq. At the time of the U.S. occupation and after. So what developed in Syria since the end of 2011, since 2012, this absolutely terrible level of violence, of destruction, of massacre, and the rest, as I said, creates an exacerbation of resentment on the other side, and I mean facilitates the development of extremist groups like those we have been seeing. So yes, I mean it's a you have this if you want dialectics of barbarisms, this clash of barbarisms that is unfolding, and in order to get out of this, well, you need the emergence of a third force opposed, I mean, to both reactionary poles. This is the key condition for anything getting us back to the kind of progressive aspiration and hopes that were prevalent in 2011, in the first year of the regional uprising.
That was Gilbert Achcar, Professor of Development Studies and International Relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Like I said at the beginning of the show, I'm more skeptical of U.S. intervention than Achcar sounds in this particular instance, but I thought his point of view, as a Marxist who spent the first three decades of his life in Lebanon, worth listening to. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another bit from that Eno Hyde collaboration, this one from a song called Lilacs. Till next week, bye.